Hello, and welcome to DIY Oberlin, a show featuring makers, crafters, artists, and hackers, and tinkerers of all ages and varieties with strong ties to Oberlin and surrounding communities. Each week, we'll feature a different maker and get to know a bit about their craft and their Oberlin story. I'm your host, Abby Oresti. Let's do this.
So you don't want too much water in your tool or in the sheet.
This week on DIY Oberlin, we're speaking with internationally renowned artist Amy Lee.
Because if you turned it too quickly and there was still a lot of water, the weight of the water would just take everything off and it would fall back into the vat.
Amy is an Oberlin alum, a papermaker, and is a leading authority on the history and technique of Korean papermaking and related crafts. It was especially exciting for me to have the opportunity to go to Cleveland to visit Amy in her studio.
So then I'm gonna try to match this up to the last sheet.
It was such a pleasure to speak with Amy, to dive deep into her practice, and to get to learn so much more about her story. I decided that there was too much good stuff to cut out. So this interview is actually going to take place over two shows. So this week, stay tuned to hear more about Amy's background and experience. And next week, make some time to join me in going to Cleveland to check out Amy's studio and artwork and learn more about the paper making process firsthand. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Amy Lee, who is an artist, papermaker, writer, and the leading Hanji researcher and practitioner in North America. Her Fulbright research on Korean paper led to her award-winning book, Hanji Unfurled, and the first U.S. Hanji studio in Cleveland. Her artwork resides in countless collections, including the Brooklyn Museum of Art, Metropolitan Museum of Art, and the Museum of Modern Art, to name just a few. She has taught and lectured at numerous institutions, including the American Museum of Natural History, Asian Art Museum, Cleveland Museum of Art, Oberlin College, where she's an alum, Mills College, UC Berkeley, University of Michigan, and Haystack Mountain School of Crafts, and many, many others. Her work has been funded by the U.S. Fulbright Program, Korea Fulbright Foundation, John Anson Kittredge Fund, American Folklore Society, and the Center for Craft. And she was the 2019 Ohio Arts Council Heritage Fellow recipient. I feel so incredibly privileged to have Amy Lee joining us today.
Thanks, Abby. It's great to be back on campus.
So I wanted to start with your Oberlin connection. You're originally from New York, right?
Yes.
And your family still lives there?
Yes.
I'm curious about how you chose Oberlin, your path here, and whether you always knew you were going to be a studio art major, or if that's something that kind of came to fore after you got here.
I actually came to Oberlin, apparently, according to my parents, kicking and screaming, because I had applied actually only to four colleges that were very strong in music and very strong in academically, because I actually wanted to be a concert violinist. And I had only heard about Oberlin through some coach at a music camp and only really knew about the conservatory. So that was, applying to the college was my way of kind of delaying an audition into the con. So I didn't get into my top choices. And then Oberlin was kind of, I guess, a safety. And then the other safety, I just didn't want to go to at all. And I asked my parents if I could do a gap year and they said no. And then I came to Oberlin very unhappy, apparently, but then immediately fell in love. And pretty quickly, even though I did music the entire 4 years I was here, pretty quickly realized that I was not concert violinist material. And when it was time to pick a major, I felt very put out. Like, it's 2 years in, how am I supposed to know? But I had taken art history class with Susan Cain, and it was interesting enough. It was more compelling than some of the other classes. And I thought, well, there's this third major, there's a studio art, there's an art history, but there's this visual art major that looks a lot less rigorous. And so I'll do that. And also it allows me to bring in classes from other departments. And so it allowed me to count music, philosophy, writing, dance, all these other things that I was doing into the art major. So I declared that. And once I started to get into studio art classes, then really, really fell in love with just making and thinking about art and thinking about what I was making and trying to incorporate everything I was doing on campus into the things I was doing.
So you were a visual art major?
Yes.
Okay, so it's different than...
It is different. And I don't know what the art department is doing now, but at the time we had three majors. And the visual art major, I think, actually was probably a little too loosely defined because it was almost like a catch-all bucket for people who wanted to do one or the other but weren't ready to commit to just a straight studio program or straight art history. And in the end, I actually look back and think, how could I have graduated with only four studio classes, four art history classes, and then say that I'm an art major? It feels so insufficient. But I also think that for what I was doing and at the time that I was doing it, it was totally fine. And they probably would have had a hard time forcing me to do more.
It sounds like a really perfect major. I mean, it sounds really nice. Like it was an opportunity to experiment and explore with a lot of different topics.
Yes.
Which I really love about really all of the Oberlin alums and students that I ever talk to. It seems like they have a lot of different classes that they're able to combine into
right.
something that really is unique to them.
Yeah. And the thing that made me sad was that I didn't find the thing that I really loved until my last semester, which was an artist books class with Nanette, and she just retired. And so that class was a real kind of mind explosion where I was introduced to this art form, artist books, that they're objects of art that are made by various artists, and you put whatever content you want in there. And some people will collaborate and some people will use other people's text or images. And I found it to be a great way for me to incorporate whatever creative writing I was doing and whatever image making I was doing. And even this idea of installation as a book, or the idea of like my final project was a doll, and like, how can a doll be a book? And being able to do a lot of storytelling through a medium that was really, really flexible, but had this grounding in really ancient techniques.
That's really great to hear, because I was really curious. As far as I know, your winter term at Oberlin is the only paper making that exists here. And I don't know if that's true historically or not.
Yeah, as far as I know. I think there may have been, back when ICA, the conservation nonprofit, was housed at Oberlin, they may have had one or two little papermaking sessions as an informal thing, but there was never any formal papermaking course at Oberlin. And still, aside from my winter term, which isn't even a semester long, there isn't. And there's a fascinating history, actually, of a lot of major Oberlin alum in the papermaking field. So how did they get there if there was no papermaking on campus? And I think there's just something about the ethos of and the environment of Oberlin that leads people into the field. And it was, you know, from Michael Durgin, who was a founder and first editor of Hand Papermaking magazine, he was an English major, and then Mina Takahashi, and she might have been an East Asian Studies major, is now the editor of Hand Papermaking magazine. Peter Sawicki, who was a retired professor in Buffalo, who made papermaking paper art and taught. And then there's so many, and it's very weird that they came at a time when there was no formal papermaking on campus. And I didn't even learn about papermaking until I went to grad school. So I didn't know about papermaking at Oberlin.
Okay, that was my next question for you. That is so fascinating. I had no idea there were so many other Oberlin alums within the papermaking community.
Right.
You're the one that I knew.
Yeah, and they're a generation or half, you know, I don't want to date them, but they're older than me. And so that they went on to create these spaces for people all over the world is really amazing.
That's so cool. I've heard you speak about growing up and speaking Korean at home, but then maybe experience in a period of distancing yourself a bit from your heritage as a high school student before then returning to it and sort of becoming this incredibly passionate and effective advocate for
Korean papermaking
specifically. And I wonder if you might speak about this journey and any ties to your time at Oberlin through that.
Well, I was born in New York. I was born in Flushing, Queens, to Korean immigrant parents who had, they had met each other in New York, actually. They'd immigrated separately. And they said Korean was my first language, which makes sense because I just hung out with them until nursery school. And then I was forced to learn English. And then my dad, fortunately, was really, he was the one, actually, my mom didn't go to college until I was, my sister and I were in college. But my dad felt like it was really important to instill language learning at home, which is very hard to do. But he taught us the alphabet and he taught us how to read and write. And he would make us do this daily practice. And they spoke Korean at home. And then as we got older, my sister and I would often just respond in English, but we would hear a lot of Korean. And then I think it's very typical for second generation people like me to then reject their culture because they're really trying to assimilate into whatever essentially white America demands. And so I got into music, I didn't care about the summer vacations we would occasionally take to Korea because I just wanted to do music camp and music study over the summer. But then when I got the summer right before Oberlin, I went to this music summer strings program where I met a 1.5 generation Korean American and a Korean American second gen like me. And they were both from New York City and did Juilliard pre-college. And they were so fun and cool to be around. But what really struck me was that they didn't have issues about being Korean American, probably because they were exposed to more of them where they grew up. And one of them in particular was very proud of being Korean. And I was so shocked to see that because I'd only seen kind of either it not being a non-issue or being ashamed of it or trying to hide it or trying to just act like that wasn't a factor in our lives. And so when I went to Oberlin, I think that kind of primed me for the political climate there. And while I wasn't that active in the Asian American and Korean American student committees and groups on campus, I had friends who were, and I could see that there was a different way of being. And so when it was time, eventually there's a whole, you know, I learned about Hanji, which is Korean paper, at the Allen Memorial Art Museum during a class that I was taking my junior year. And it was a requirement for this major. And it was in Chinese landscape painting. And we went to see these landscape scrolls that the museum had just acquired. And the curator at the time said, oh, this one is actually done on Korean paper because Chinese painters preferred Korean paper. And it was like this total, again, this mind-blowing event where I thought, why am I in this class to learn about Chinese landscape painting when I don't know anything about Korean art? And it was so insane to me that, oh wow, Chinese painters would have preferred non-Chinese paper. I thought the Chinese made everything and it was great. And so this idea that there was a space for me in history helped me realize that I had been rejecting my culture and language in a way that might be detrimental and that if I wanted to learn more, I really had to return to the language. And so I think at that time I was 19 or 20 and I actually called home to my parents from campus when we had phones in our dorm rooms and no cell phones. And I said, I actually don't want to do music camp this summer because it's clear I'm not going to be a concert violinist. I want to go to Korea and study the language. And that was, again, through music because a violist that I knew from back in New York had done this language study camp and done a music extracurricular that he loved. And so I thought, oh, it'd be a cool way to do both. And that was the summer that I essentially very consciously decided to return to speaking Korean to my parents. And then that set me up for being able to, later, 10 years later, on my Fulbright research to speak Korean and do the research in Korean.
And if you are just joining us, this is WOBC Oberlin, 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. And you are listening to DIY Oberlin, a show featuring makers, crafters, artists, and hackers and tinkerers of all ages and varieties with strong ties to Oberlin and surrounding communities. This week on the show, we're speaking with internationally renowned artist Amy Lee.
So you graduated from Oberlin, and then there was a period in between. Did you stay in the Cleveland area during that period?
No. So after I graduated from Oberlin, I had friends. I graduated in 99, and so there was this huge dot-com boom going on in the Bay Area, and I had friends who really wanted to go out there, and it seemed like a very cool, hip place to go, even though I hadn't ever been to California. So I got a temp job, and I had an old Oberlin friend she sublet her place to me, and I just stayed in a basement in the Sunset District of San Francisco, and it was so miserable because I had no idea that California was so cold in the summer, and I was not prepared at all, and I didn't know it was so foggy, and I temped for a month, and then I thought, this is not fun, and I'm just gonna save money by moving back home to New York, and I can temp at home but save the rent money, and then I can figure out a way to get back to California. But of course I started temping, and then another Oberlin friend. So I had a string quartet when I was on campus, and it was all non-Connie majors who just loved music. And my violist happened to be, who is now a professor in wetlands ecology. And she's incredible, Karen Kettenring. But her mom, Pat Kettenring, was the head of the art and business department at Rutgers University. And she heard about a job opening in Newark at the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra for an education manager. And so she put me up for the job, and I got it. And so it seemed like the perfect meld of what I was doing on campus, which was running the Oberlin Music Coalition, which was a way of trying to incorporate the community of Oberlin at large with the Con, and having a lot of Con students teach free private lessons to kids who couldn't afford it normally, having an instrument drive and rentals for kids who, if you can't afford lessons, you definitely can't afford an instrument, having big concerts for schools, having early childhood education, and all of this free of charge. And so I thought, this is a great segue into this job, because I'm running a youth orchestra and a chamber orchestra and a community chorus, and I'm still embedded with musicians and doing in this like environment that I really love. But It was the usual. I burned out very quickly. I think I lasted a year and a half. And then I quit and I ended up moving home. My parents went to Korea for a while because my father's uncle, who was married to his aunt, so not uncle by blood, but his uncle became the president of South Korea. And so Kim Dae-jung. So they went there for a little while. I took care of their home. In the meantime, taught private violin lessons until I realized I should get a job with benefits again, and happened to get a grants officer job at the New York Foundation for the Arts, where I was able to give grants away to people in 16 different categories, ranging all the way from music composition to choreography to film to video, painting, drawing, playwriting, screenwriting, fiction, nonfiction, all these things. And it was a huge education in the art world and how to apply for grants, how they're administered, how not to take it personally when you get rejected, because most people do. And it's sometimes because the jury is just sleeping because it was after lunch and they're digesting their food. So in that process, I saw thousands of artist statements and resumes and applications, and then, of course, images of work. And I thought, I can do this. I think it's time to go back to grad school, which I really just kind of did almost blindfolded. I didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't get in when I first applied to one school. Again, I have this history of only not applying to enough schools, but the next round of applications the following year, I realized I should apply in the thing that my portfolio is strongest in, and that happened to be artist books. So I chose book arts programs, and then the one program that I got into was at Columbia College in Chicago, and it was an interdisciplinary book and paper art program, which allowed me to bring my violin, to bring my ideas of trying to combine performance and paper, or performance and books, actually, because I didn't know about paper then. And then when I got to grad school, the first studio class was a papermaking class, and then I completely fell in love with that process. And in the course of learning about the history of papermaking, I saw that we didn't have enough research in English about Korean papermaking. And then that was where I could finally see a way for me to continue doing this art form that I had recently fallen in love with, but have it connect back to my heritage. And that's when I applied. Well, I applied for the Fulbright probably 2 years out of grad school, and then went for a full year, and probably more than that, because I had an extra critical language enhancement award so I could study more Korean. And then that essentially changed the trajectory of my career.
I wanted to pick up on a thread that you just sort of threw out there that blew my mind for a second. The performance, the connection between sort of violin and book arts, or performance and book arts. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Well, I was still so into performance, and not that I had been performing that much. I did one little violin improv thing at, I don't even remember which theater in New York City, with a dance company, because I had happened to take these like circus acrobatics standing trapeze classes with one of the members of the company. When you're in your early 20s, you have a lot of energy. You're so excited to be working in New York City. And I had another Oberlin friend who I had met in dance classes, Ellen Koh. And she was actually, I think she actually was supposed to be a physics major, but she was an amazing performer. And she happened to be in New York, and she told me about this acrobatics or circus class at the Kitchen. And so we started taking it, and we would go every Monday, and it was a great way to hang out. But also, when you're also very strong when you're in your early 20s, and just very headstrong, and you don't worry about injuries. But it was taught by two very competent women who, you know, we were always spotted and protected. And so that, I think this I always loved performing, and I still do, which is, I think, why I teach. That's where I get my kicks out. But I think that I just love to take classes and things that I didn't know about, that even when I went to grad school on the side, I would go to the Old Town School of Music, and I took a hula class and I took a breakdancing class, because I wanted to do things that scared me, that I thought, that I just really just wanted to push myself beyond my comfort limits. And I learned a lot. A lot of bad things also happened, but, you know.
Did you then incorporate any of that into your art practice, or did you shift gears?
I knew enough at that point that was the classes I was taking was, it was almost for fitness and enlightenment and fun. And there was no way, even at that point, being kind of, well, I wouldn't say even unenlightened, because I'd gone to Oberlin. I knew, why would I incorporate something of another culture into my work that I was just going to classes once a week for? But what I was trying to do when I first went to grad school, and this was at a time actually, and I don't know if Oberlin still does this, Oberlin actually gave me money to go to grad school. There were scholarships for Oberlin alum to go to grad school. So I applied and got $5,000, which at the time seemed like an incredible amount of money because I was young. And the proposal was, I want to go to grad school to combine book and performance art. And there was one artist, Susan Joy Scher, who did that. And it was almost in a more literal way. Like, she would have these giant books on stage that were the size of a human, and then she would interact with them in, I think she would be wearing leotards. And I didn't want it to be that literal. But what happened was, because I fell in love with papermaking, and it was literally the first class I took. It was a morning class. And so it was the first studio class I ever took, rather than doing the trajectory that I thought, which was immediately starting to take artist books classes and bookbinding classes. I actually went deeper into paper, and there was a performance class there so that I could explore that combination more. And the way that I then incorporated it was by making paper costumes that would make sound as I played the violin, and then using paper as a way of communicating with the audience, because I would do a lot of durational, interactional performances where I would instruct them to write certain things to me, and then I would read them and then interpret that through music. And so there were a lot of, also the Columbia at the time had these residencies where I got to work with performance artists. And so Julie Lafine was one who did huge scale garments. And then I learned so much from her. And then Greg Allen, who was also an Oberlin alum, and he started the Neo Futurists, which is a theater company in Chicago. And I learned so much from him. We're still good friends. And his son ended up going to Case, so we got to see each other when they would come, or his stepson when he would come through Cleveland. But yeah, so there have always been all these Oberlin connections throughout. And so I tried to do this combination, and I would use paper in various ways in these performances. And then I did that all the way through grad school. I would perform in Chicago. And then at the end of grad school, I got into a residency called Art Farm in Nebraska. And I did one last big performance in this big barn, and my violin, and there was a typewriter, and there was, and then I started to think about, I think that these performances only work because of the body that I'm in, which happens to be a young, female, thin, Asian body. And I don't know if it would work if I looked different. And I thought, I don't really want to perform if it's really contingent on what my body looks like and what all the people out there, what their assumptions are of what that kind of body should be doing or not doing. And in a way where I think I was looking towards the future thinking, what if I get older or I gain weight or something that I won't be able to have the draw? And so it felt almost like the audience, the people who were responding the most enthusiastically, it felt very voyeuristic and like it was a very male gaze. And so because I was getting really deeply into my papermaking, I decided to take a hiatus from performing, and that almost dovetailed really well with then getting into Korean papermaking. And people still ask me today, do you still practice? Do you still play violin? Do you still do all these things? And I always tell them I don't, because if you know anything about either music or craft, you have to spend an incredible amount of time honing both of those things. And it's really hard to balance. I mean, I don't know. I really don't know how my friends in the con were able to do double degrees and all that based on how much they have to actually just practice. And so I would not want to, I just knew I really wanted to go fully into the papermaking.
And if you are just joining us, this is WOBC Oberlin, 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. And you are listening to DIY Oberlin, a show featuring makers, crafters, artists, and hackers, and tinkerers of all ages and varieties with strong ties to Oberlin and surrounding communities. This week on DIY Oberlin, we're speaking with internationally renowned artist Amy Lee.
That dovetails nicely with a question I wanted to ask you specifically about the craft and the practice. For those who haven't yet visited your website, definitely do. because, you know, there's artist books, knitted books, the Hanji ducks, and the papermaking dresses. And tell me a little bit more, even just picking one process, about kind of how that looks for folks who maybe aren't familiar.
Well, I always just make what I want to make. And there are times where I'm asked to do something, it really constipates the process. And so I don't even, you know, it's been now over 20 years since I left college, and I still make artist books. So that's kind of this through line that I've had throughout. So this very reliable kind of almost like a stream that's under the concrete. And so I always know that that's something that I can do. And if I could do more of it, it would be great. But then the way that I've incorporated the Korean paper into that is sometimes very obvious. You just use the Korean paper, you use Hanji for the books. But now there's subject matter that comes up through the research. And one of the questions that I had seen you pose in the preliminary sheet was, who inspires you or what inspires you? And I always remember how difficult this was, even when I was interviewing for my studio art class with Johnny Coleman, who's also now retired. And he asked, you know, who are your artistic inspirations? And I just totally blanked and I started crying, which is very typical, you know, response. And it was very embarrassing. And I thought I bombed it. And I thought I didn't get in. Thank God he let me in, because it was really a life-changing class. But I realize now it's because right now my inspirations are so much from nameless people. So I look a lot at Korean art that's in museum collections, and also because I have access to curators or conservators, they alert me to things that are in storage that the public never sees. And so I've seen these things, and none of them are attributed to anyone. And so I'm really inspired by objects that had significance, that were symbolic throughout Korean history. And so the ducks are a very easy way of looking back at Korean wedding ducks, which were a tradition that started, and remember, this is very heteronormative, man and woman getting married, and usually they're coming from different villages and different families, and obviously different families, but they would first come with live geese, male and female, because this is agricultural society, it's very useful. And then it started to become more symbolic over time, and they would carve wooden ducks that look like mandarin ducks, which are a species known to mate for life. And so that was supposed to indicate a wish for marital fidelity and fertility, because it was important to have lots of babies. And then I saw an image of a 19th century woven paper duck, and it looked so weird and wonky. And only if you knew the traditional wooden figures would you really even know what this was. And I just was so compelled by the look of it and the gestures of it that I immediately wanted to make it. And it was using a Korean process called jisung, which is essentially paper basketry, where you take paper, you cut it into strips, you turn the strips into cords, like almost like rope, and then you use those to twine, which is a form of basketry. So some people will call it paper weaving, but it's not exactly the same. Weaving and basketry, or weaving and twining, are a little different. And so I had been trained by a third generation master to make all kinds of historical Korean objects using this process. So chamber pots and teapots and gourds and lamps. And then, of course, because I was an artist, I would try to convert it to use for book covers or anything that I wanted to make. And so the duck became a really great technical challenge, because it's actually quite difficult to essentially sculpt a basket. And so I started doing it, and then I was having a hard time. I was doing it while I was teaching at Penland, and my students were making fun of me because the neck was so long, and they were saying, "Amy, have you ever seen a real duck before?" And really, the thing is, it's a symbol of something else, especially if it came from a geese way back, you know, from geese way back then. So then I was able to get the Kittredge grant to go back to Korea a second time and do advanced study with my jisung teacher and show him, this is what I want to do. And then really be able to learn how to essentially make curves in this manner. And so then I, after that, had a great residency at Haystack Mountain School of Craft, and just 2 weeks in the textile studio, just figuring it out. And I came out with four just so, like, my favorite ducks. And it's not even that they were my first after having this study, but they were just so perfect. And that's also why they sold immediately, except for one that I'm keeping. And for me, it wasn't, I just want to make straight up wedding ducks, but I want to see what's the next evolution. What is this generation of ducks, especially because we're coming out of a time where it's like, well, it's not just going to be a man and a woman getting married, and maybe you're never going to get married, and maybe people want to be alone. And so the ducks just turning into their own creatures again. It's almost like going from the real geese to the symbol, and then back to getting closer to itself, but being able to have more agency. And so whether I open the beak so it looks like they're actually making noise, or I open their wings so it looks like they have more range of motion. So that's, and then I use a lot of natural dyes, which I also learned to do in Korea, to get all the colors for these ducks.
I'd love to hear more about some of your study in Korea. It sounds like you've been several times, the Fulbright in 2008, is that right? Mm-hmm. And then you said a second trip.
Yeah, in 2014. And then the third trip was the second Fulbright in 2021. So I was able to study with, in the first trip, I was able to learn how to make hanji from Chang Sung-woo, who was the son of Chang Yong-hoon, who has since passed away, who was the provincial and then the national bearer of that tradition of hanji making in Korea, and then also study with Kim Kyung for chumchi, which is texturing and fusing hanji, with Na Seo Hwan, who was teaching me chisung, Shim Hyun Sup, who was teaching me calligraphy, Im Young Sun, who was teaching me natural dyeing along with his wife. And this is, when I first went to Korea, I thought, I just need to learn how to make paper. Who cares about anything else? But it became very clear in the paper making process. My teacher actually had these wonderful books that I could sit and read when I was taking breaks. And I could see immediately that the Korean, we're not even Korean, the human desire is to go towards color. And so then I realized, oh, I should try to find a natural dyeing teacher. And I was able to find one. And then my hanji teacher said, oh, you should learn how to do this. And he first taught me a little bit of chisung. And then he said, you should meet my teacher, because he saw what a good student I was. And so he really forced me essentially to meet his teacher. And he forced both my chisung teacher and myself to start these lessons, because he said, this will be great. And I thought, oh, but I've already learned to make hanji. Why do I have to do this? Can't I just coast for the rest of my grant like some other people are doing? And so, but I did it. And that really, really changed everything for me. And then the calligraphy, again, is to understand why this paper was made, because it was made for brush and ink. Like, I needed to see what the relationship between the brush and ink and paper was. And the chumchi was also a way to understand kind of the tactile and textile nature of paper, because I realized to be able to fully essentially export it to the States, I had to make hanji really compelling in a context. I couldn't just be like, oh, look at the cool way that they made paper hundreds of years ago. I had to then be able to tell the story of what did they do with the paper, and what did they do that was maybe a little different from what the Japanese did or the Chinese did. And so I realized that the more I learned about this kind of contextual craft work, the stronger my case would be that it was important to keep supporting the hanji industry. And that's part of also why I work in so many different ways, because I want to use all these different techniques.
Now, did you go knowing or with the idea in the back of your mind of writing a book, or did that come naturally from the experience?
What's hilarious is when I look back at my first application for the first Fulbright, it's the most concise, clear application that predicts the future, which is where I say, I want to do all these things and go back to America, and maybe I'll teach, or maybe I'll open a studio, or maybe I'll write a book. And I did all of the things that I said I was going to do, I did, which is really rare for people who know anything about grant writing. Mostly it's you're just trying to tell them what they want to hear. And so I think that I didn't want to do it right away. I had some pressure to. I just really, you really have to, after experiences like that, you need time to digest. And that's why I think it's really important. I tell my students all the time, after Oberlin, I wanted to start working, not go to grad school immediately. Obviously, for certain fields, you'd have to go to grad school immediately. But as an artist, it's important to have life experience. And after grad school, I didn't go to Korea immediately. And that's also important to know about Fulbright grants. You don't have to apply when you're in school. You can apply after, a little bit after. And so I wanted to do the hanji research for myself, to feel like I could embed this craft in my body and my practice and distinguish myself from what I saw as kind of kind of nascent field of paper making as art or paper art, that it all looked very similar and people were still trying to figure out ways to distinguish themselves. And I realized this can be my way to create my own niche. And so I wanted to just really immerse myself completely in the Korean ways and then figure out a way to respectfully share that with the public. And some of the things I did immediately, even when I was in country in Korea, as I started uploaded all of my videos that I edited, shot and edited, all my photos, I blogged all the time so that people could kind of follow me on the journey. And that actually was so useful for writing the book, because then if I would forget anything, I would just go back to the blog. And if I had to date anything, it was all there. And same with my photos and my notes. I took tons and tons of notes. And so when it was time to write the book, I knew I didn't want to write a book that was just a kind of dry, quote unquote, objective textbook on Hanji. I wanted to say this is just one person's way of doing it. And that's it's not the only way. But what I am really happy about is that it made real the possibility of doing this for other people. And I know it's inspired a lot of other students. And I've since helped a lot of other people get Fulbrights, whether to Korea or other countries, and continue to help them. And so it's nice to see that continuing wave now. It's not just me. For the longest time, it was just me teaching Hanji and sharing it with the English-speaking communities and even beyond. I mean, I was teaching in Chile, which is not an English-speaking community. But now I don't have to bear that burden all by myself because there are these other people who are really enthusiastically taking it up.
So there's been this ripple effect, which sounds really beautiful. I'd love to hear more about your teaching. As you were saying a moment ago about the documentation, it's something that I try to drive home with my students. I'm going to make them listen to that. Just how important it is as you're going and not trying to save it all for the end.
And if you are just joining us, this is WOBC Oberlin, 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. And you are listening to DIY Oberlin, a show featuring makers, crafters, artists, and hackers, and tinkerers of all ages and varieties with strong ties to Oberlin and surrounding communities. This week on DIY Oberlin, we're speaking with internationally renowned artist Amy Lee. Amy is an Oberlin alum, a papermaker, and is a leading authority on the history and technique of Korean papermaking and related crafts.
I would love to hear more about your teaching. I think the first time I met you was at the Winter Term Fair here at Oberlin. I know you've taught the Winter Term Papermaking Intensive here for many years, and maybe that's a good jumping off point. I'm so jealous of your students. I always want to take that class, and I'm always thinking, oh, I wish I could be over there. And you've so generously did a workshop for my students, which was a highlight of our semester. So yeah, tell me more maybe about the Winter Term and then some of the other many experiences, teaching experiences you've had.
Well, there was... I built this Hanji studio in Cleveland at the Morgan Conservatory in 2010. And that was a weird confluence of things that ended up making that happen. I had never planned at all to come back to this area or anything, but they were the most supportive of doing such a huge project like this. And so I really credit Tom Balbo with giving the go-ahead. And he raised some money, I raised some money. And then by doing that, I was able to reconnect with my Oberlin connections, especially the librarians. And one of them was Ed Vermeu, who's special collections librarian at the main library. And he had been taking, he was keyed into the Morgan immediately and was taking his students on field trips. And also students were going for internships. And so we talked about, is there anything that I could do for Oberlin? And he had already started this amazing letterpress studio in the library. And I wanted to be able to give papermaking back to Oberlin because so it's been so important to me. And so first we had to scout and find a location because it's a very wet process and messy and you need all this kind of plumbing. And Ed was so ingenious that he actually scoped out places in Hales, which is old deaccession gym. And we were able to get permissions from facilities to use this old... It's essentially a gang shower when people used to all shower in the same room together, and then the attached changing room, and they were both completely tiled, still had intact floor drains, intact water coming in, and then we just had facilities put hose bibs onto two of the shower heads, and then we could have the water. And then for the first several years, I designed a course that I wanted to be very comprehensive. So you would learn to make paper from scratch, from the plants that you would use in many parts of East Asia, and then do it in East Asian styles, and then also make paper in European styles, and then learn to decorate the paper in different cultural ways, whether it's paste papers, marbling, suminagashi, and then take all the paper that you've made and decorated, and then we would do that for 2 weeks, and then move into the main library for 2 weeks, and just make books out of the papers, and again, making books in different ways. So Asian techniques and European techniques and American techniques. And And then at the end, we would have an exhibit at the library. And this, if I only could have done it again in my, that was, I was in my 30s and still, I still had a lot of energy and thought this was a great idea that we could do all in a month. And over time, I've realized it's really a lot. And so I learned to, you would never know. I think someone on the outside would not be able to tell the difference. But the big change has been the first several years, we would rent all the equipment for papermaking from the Morgan Conservatory. I would help them pack a van that would be driven over and make all the students unload it and then set up the studio. And then 2 weeks later, break it all down, reload the van. And after a while, it just became so frustrating because it's a lot of work to move a paper studio and set it up and only use it for 2 weeks. So luckily at the time, Alexia, who was the director of the library system, she said, you know, let's just build it out. Let's just commit to it. And so I'm so grateful to her because then we could outfit the whole thing and just have a permanent paper studio there. And that has been a huge game changer for me, mostly labor-wise, but also to know that students, that they have some access to it. I wish they had more. The problem is that I'm not here during their semester. So it really is kind of laying fallow then, but I would love in the future for there to be semester long classes so they can actually use the space because it's set up for both types of both European and Asian types of papermaking, which a lot of studios don't have. A lot of studios in America only focus on European style papermaking. So that's still a conversation in progress, but it's been so, so gratifying from the very first class. The students were so excited just to work with their hands and to make things and learn how to work from scratch to see some piece of bark turn into a piece of paper that they can bind into a book and then give to their mom or use as a sketchbook. And it's been also really great to see what they do with that. And so there are some students that have gone on to really incorporate it into their creative writing careers or into, you know, go all the way through and get jobs in every single major papermaking, either organization or place that offers classes and to be able to be a scholarship student or a fellow or go to grad school or get their MFA at Yale and just see the way that that's changed their trajectory so much earlier than I was able to access papermaking. So that's been really, it's this longer relationship. This next winter term will be our 10th year running this class. And so it's great to see the way it grows. And then the rest of the teaching I do is just all over the place. That would be a whole other story.
I mean, it's so wonderful that you've been able, as a working artist with so many commitments all around the world, to carve out that month in January to teach here. So fortunate for our students, for us as a community. And I also am so excited that Hales finally is actually a paper making studio, selfishly, of course, because it meant that we were able to find some funds and bring you back to actually teach this workshop for my students, which never could have happened if you had to build a studio from scratch for you know, a day long workshop, right? That's just not viable. So I think maybe even in the interim, as hopefully working towards more access for students, it seems like it already facilitates opportunities for this kind of connection. And, you know, for students who maybe haven't yet had the foresight to sign up for your winter term or couldn't get in because it's so popular, it's a little taste.
Definitely. And we have had students who, the ones that are the most responsible and the most dedicated and have exhibited that they can work unsupervised. There are two that were able to work together on a project and they would harvest plants from the arboretum and then process them and make paper out of them in the studio on their own.
Ooh, I didn't know about that. Were they studio art majors?
Or? No, one of them, Lauren, was an art history major and Michelle is, well, I guess Michelle is a double degree studio art and music composition major.
Okay. Awesome. I would love to hear, maybe this is circling back a little bit to something we had touched on, but it's about two particular projects I saw on your website that are maybe a little bit more installation and or performance-based. I think maybe more installation. One of them was Boundless and the other was Hunk and Dora. I think they were maybe different times in your career. I'd love to just hear a little bit about either or both.
Well, Hunk and Dora was my MFA thesis in Chicago. And that was, it was a 14-foot brick tower, but all the bricks were made out of paper. And I made over 2,000 bricks to prepare for that. And it was meant to be a self-portrait. And it was looking at the way that walls are kind of a joke, or they don't work. And so the idea was, especially at that time, I was still in my 20s, so still very hormonal and going through a lot of like a long distance romantic drama. And so I thought a lot about how when you are hurt, that often the impulse is that if you just close up your heart, that you won't get hurt again, which is so stupid, and it just doesn't work that way. And it actually can be more damaging. And so this idea of building walls around your heart or building walls around yourself can be really damaging. But what I wanted to do was build a wall that made fun of all the things that a wall actually does. And so this wall can't even stand on its own. It's actually hung from the top down. So it's hung from the ceiling, and I just start to build it all the way down. And it just kind of hovers and rests on the floor, but it would fall down if it didn't have the ceiling supports. And then it has no mortar. You can basically, because they're glued and tied together, you can see through the cracks. It moves as you walk by it, so it's obviously not sturdy. It has a whole doorway that you can enter, so then it's not blocking anything. And it's translucent, so light can come through it. And then when you come in on the other side, the backs, the way that I built them with these molds, the front of the brick looks like a brick, but then the back is totally open, so it almost looks like a honeycomb or something. And so it's just a totally different experience. And it was combined with a performance at the time where I was inside, and I had all these loose bricks on the outside, and you could bring in a loose brick and then just tell me a story about yourself. And as I listened, I would draw a comic of you. So it was like I was drawing a portrait of you within my self-portrait, and then I would give it to you, and then you would go away. Because at the time, gifting was a big part of my work, and comics as well. So that was just kind of my way of trying to throw it all into the thesis. But later iterations, I then moved it to the Fuller Craft Museum outside of Boston for a show, and I almost inverted parts of it, and it was even more kind of open and weird because the space was different. And then after that, I got so tired of storing it, because at the time I was staying with my parents in New York, and I just felt so badly for using their entire basement storage closet in an apartment building that I ended up just throwing out a lot of them and only keeping a few chunks, because it was so difficult to install. And you forget. It's very much like what I hear about having a baby, because I haven't had any, but that you forget about the pain of it. And so when I had first been installing, it was so hard. And then when I went back to the craft museum and I was installing, I thought, I never want to do this again. The only way I can do it by destroying it, because then I won't do it again. And so that worked for a little while. And then when I moved to Cleveland, I moved in 2013. And then in 2020, I was asked to have a solo show at the Sculpture Center. And then it was pandemic, and I just could not worry about making new art. And I thought, why don't I just fall back on this thing that I never thought I would go back to? Because I thought it was just a gimmick to go back to old work. But now as an older artist, I realize it's actually, everything is cyclical. So you almost have to go back to your old work and revisit it. And it's totally valid. And so I started making more bricks because I knew how to do it. So I didn't have to worry about teaching myself a new process. And I was just working in my basement at the time. And it felt very soothing. And I made just a little mini version. But this time, instead of being a tower, I just wanted it to be one straight wall, but have it disintegrate as it went down. So it was all kind of intact from the top. And then as you go down, they just start having more and more space in between. And then after that show, I redid it for the Cannes Triennial in 2022, I think, and just made it bigger. And then this fall, I will take it to the Reif Gallery down Columbus to be part of their annual juried show. So it takes on these different kind of lives. And actually, I used to give these talks and introduce myself with that piece all the time. And then after the 2016 election and just the chaos that ensued, it became even more wild that I would be talking about walls and how ridiculous they are. So like that, again, it's just you, there's always something to this work that you can revisit, and it takes on new meaning every time.
Wow. I feel like I'm so glad to hear that. Also, there might be a chance, you said this fall in Columbus to actually get to see. It's not so far away.
Right. So it'll be in Columbus. And then that show is actually going to travel to Warren, Ohio. And it'll finish up there in, I think, January.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah, maybe that's a good place to ask sort of a wrapping up question, imagining that your audience is current Oberlin students or others who are just inspired by your work, your trajectory. What advice would you have for them in terms of that transition from, you know, the sort of very generative time of being in school and being able to kind of experiment and learn new things to making your way as an artist or a creative person in the world?
Well, it's always important to take advantage of as much of the resources, as many of the resources on campus as possible. There are so, so many. I think about the paper studio and how I work so, I mean, I've spent years of my life dedicated to this place, and probably most of the population doesn't even know it's there. But that's the case for so many other little pockets at Oberlin. And so it's just, it's not a matter of trying to do everything, but really trying to find the thing that resonates the most with you. And there's always more behind that. And I see that even I had a student who, he is a bio and neuroscience double major, and he's really into that kind of research, but then also has these minors in book studies and East Asian studies and probably something else, and then taught a Chinese calligraphy expo and took my winter term, and somehow finds time to do all these things even though he's going to go into his honors senior year. And so I think it's just about really being open to all the things that are available to you, and also being open to being really messy. Like, nothing is going to be, nothing is final. Nothing is going to make or break you as an artist when you're here. And if anything, it's a great place to make mistakes. I've done lots of things that I never want to see again and behaved in ways that I wish I hadn't, but it's all part of a learning experience. And obviously, you know, you try not to hurt people along the way, but it's just such a rich ground to just try many different things and really, really take advantage of the resources you have in your, essentially your elders, not just the teachers, but the staff and the people in the community, because there's something, if you have a question about something, you can find it. You can find it here. And that's really, I think, the older I get, the power, that the most powerful thing is not in knowing everything, but in knowing how to get the information. And it's not online. This is not about going online to search for it or asking the chatbot. It's really knowing the people who have these deep resources and connections.
No, that's excellent advice. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to chat with me. It has been such an honor and privilege to hear more about your story.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
That's it for this week, but please be sure to join me next week on DIY Oberlin when I travel to Cleveland to visit Amy's papermaking studio and to learn about her papermaking process firsthand. Okay, it's time for our two PSAs. Oberlin Community Services, OCS, is a responsive, community-based organization that serves low-income and vulnerable community members by providing food, financial assistance, referrals, educational outreach, and other basic needs. For more information, check out oberlincommunityservices.org. Playgroup and Storytime for Kids happens Fridays at 11 a.m. at the Oberlin Public Library, with playtime, stories, and crafts. For more information, check out oberlinlibrary.org. The opening credits for DIY Oberlin are an excerpt from my piece Limit Switch, as performed by Oberlin Professor Percussion Ross Carr. The closing credits are by Kira Salt.